An Ohio Supreme Court ruling earlier this month raises questions for domestic violence survivors and whether their abusers will be able to regain their rights to own guns. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss the ruling's implications and help available for survivors are Women Helping Women President and CEO Kristen Shrimplin. Welcome back, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
And Legal Aid Society of Greater Cincinnati Senior Supervising Attorney Ivory McGuire. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ivory. Lucy. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks so much for being here. Ivory, this ruling earlier this month involved a man with a 20-year-old felony domestic violence conviction. Can you explain the case for us?
Yeah. So on June 2nd, the Supreme Court in Ohio issued a decision and their eyes clarified how to handle an application to have firearm disability lifted when the conviction also applies a federal prohibition for firearm ownership and possession.
So as I understand it, this man was convicted many, many years ago, served time in prison for this domestic violence charge. And
yes, it was a felony conviction for domestic violence. It was 17 years ago. And in Ohio, under Ohio law that prevented him from being allowed to own firearms. However, having this conviction as well, because it was a conviction that was punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. It also applied 18 U.S.C. 922G1, which is a federal code that prevented him from having and possessing firearms. Mm-hmm. So in the third district trial court in Allen County, Ohio, he applied for relief under RC 2923.14 to be allowed to own firearms again because it had been 17 years since he had this conviction. And the trial court found that he was disabled from having firearms under federal law, so he wasn't allowed to be, could not get his guns back. So he appealed to the third district in Ohio. The third district said that because the conviction, the domestic violence conviction in Ohio, was also the conviction that prevented him federally from owning firearms, that he was otherwise prevented from owning firearms.
The federal law said you can't have your guns, mm-hmm. so that's the deal. And then as I understand it, Kristen, he appealed. Ultimately, this case went to the Ohio Supreme Court. The Ohio Supreme Court ruled how they did. Now, this federal law that prohibits people who serve more than a year in prison for domestic violence from owning a gun, as you understand it, Kristen, is that designed to protect survivors? Is that what that's all about?
I think there are definitely elements here to protect survivors. And while the, you know, the courts are going to have their legal debate, right? And we're looking at federal, we're looking at state and the rulings that are coming out. The legal discourse is incredibly important. But I want to underscore, this is a public safety discussion that we have to center. So when courts make their rulings, when policymakers make their decisions, the question has to be, how will this impact survivors? How will this impact survivors' families? How will this impact the community and the region? And I want to level set here for Ohio with something very, very specific. We are going through a 37% spike in domestic violence homicide. This is our state. In that 37% spike in domestic violence homicide, this is a record in over 10 years. 84% of those homicides were with a gun. So this legal discussion, it's not about the Second Amendment. This is not a constitutional discussion. This is a discussion that we have to center around survivors. And I want to go back for a moment, because it's easy to say numbers. When we say that 37% spike in domestic violence homicides in Ohio, who are we talking about? We are talking about in that three teenage girls were killed, three pregnant women, 11 youth. Within that, children and babies, the youngest was 4 months old. Mm. And on the flip side, the oldest victim was 89 years old. So I think it's very important when we have the, you know, the legal discourse and we're looking at access to firearms, we really have to also be looking at and take a pulse check. Real time, boots on the ground, what is happening in our communities, and a pulse check with policymakers. Because fundamentally, domestic violence, and specifically domestic violence homicide, is absolutely preventable.
Well, and we just had this Skyline waitress who was stabbed to death. That didn't involve a firearm, but we just had a deadly gender-based violence case recently. Yeah. Well, Ivory, I really appreciate what Kristen is saying about the public safety aspect of this, but from a legal standpoint, is there a conflict between the state and federal laws about firearm ownership for people convicted of domestic violence?
So I think looking at Justice Bruner's dissent is really helpful in this case. The way she frames it is that the two laws are independent of each other, and just because the domestic violence conviction that Mr. Heffler experienced in Ohio also banned him from owning guns under the federal code, doesn't mean that the exclusion applies when the Ohio code says otherwise prohibited by law from acquiring or having or using firearms. The majority opinion here kind of conflated the laws and essentially issued a decision that, in my opinion, state law could overrule federal law here because he was convicted for domestic violence, a federal or a felony conviction in Ohio. And yet, despite this federal code that says because he was convicted of a felony, he's now able to petition to have firearms. And as we've all were taught in law school, federal law is supposed to supersede state law here. And so I do think it adds a conflict here. I think this not only does it put people at risk, but I'm not sure that the Supreme Court got it right in their legal analysis here.
Yeah. Well, and Kristen, you've referenced domestic violence, how much more dangerous it is when a gun is involved.
Absolutely. When a gun is involved with domestic violence, it is a 500% increased risk of homicide. 500%. And I have to sit with that number because it's not 5%, it's not 50%, which would be striking. We're talking about 500% increase in domestic violence homicide. So when we're looking at the statistics and when we're looking at the reality, when we're looking at rulings and we're looking at legal discourse, community safety, infrastructure discourse, a lot of this is predictive. So my question is, if a gun is involved with domestic violence, there's a 500% increase in homicide. What are we going to change? What are we going to change in this region? What are we going to change in this state? Because right now, those lives are lost in the 37% spike in Ohio. And so, you know, as the legal, you know, framework, stands, then we really have to take the work around judges being equipped with a very rigorous review before reestablishing the rights for that firearm. And that includes a lethality assessment, victim notification, victim input. Talk to those who have been impacted by this. What is it looking like with stalking behavior? What is it looking like with strangulation? Are there other things that are happening that are pointing to a predictive nature that if a gun is placed back into the possession of this individual, that repeat violence will happen again?
We're talking in this recorded interview about what a recent Ohio Supreme Court ruling could mean for survivors of domestic violence. We're also going to talk about help available for survivors locally. I want to ask you both, have either of you heard from survivors who are worried about what this ruling could mean for them and their safety? Ivory, I don't know if you've heard from clients who are really nervous about this.
Yeah, I mean, as Kristen said, I think it's 84% of the fatalities in Ohio in 2025 were from gun violence. And also, recidivism rates are very high with domestic violence. If you look at someone who has been charged with domestic violence, a lot of times they've been charged multiple times for the same crime. And Kristen mentioned with stalking issues, this person doesn't go away just because the relationship is over. So it is concerning for people who have had abusers in the past, even if they have separated from that relationship, there is a safety risk there. And my clients are feeling it.
Yeah. Kristen, what are you all hearing from survivors?
Yeah, we are hearing every single day. We're a 24/7 agency that's responding to about 10,000 survivors. So the bad news here is a vast majority of the survivors we serve have increased risk for lethality. So lethality, you know, that can be, you know, when we're looking at lethality indicators, that can be a bit of a wonky word and a professional word to use. But what we're talking about is a vast majority are experiencing weapons being used against them, threats of weapons being used against them, threats that they will be killed, threats that if they don't do whatever the individual is wanting to control them to do, that the individual is going to then go commit suicide. So threats of suicide. We are seeing huge spikes among those we serve. 55% are experiencing strangulation, which is a huge red flag for what's to come next in terms of lethality. So I really wish I could say that this is merely a theoretical legal conversation. No, this is absolutely a real day in the life experience of survivors and their children. And I have to point back to the surge in domestic violence homicides we had. Those are impacting the survivor and, of course, their children. And frankly, I just know that this state, we can do better.
It's got to be terrifying for them to think that it could be easier for their abusers to get their gun rights restored.
Absolutely.
Ivory, how difficult is it for survivors to get restraining orders against their abusers? Because I think some people who've never had experience with this or don't have loved ones who've experienced this think, well, why don't they just go get a restraining order and that'll fix everything? How difficult is that process? Do some people not even go through the process or give up because of its complications?
Oh, absolutely. For starters, I am glad that we have this legal remedy, getting a domestic violence or a stalking civil protection order for people who need it. However, just the way the legal system is set up, there's just innate barriers, right? The courts only open from 8 to 4 every day. You have to go down to the court to file. In Hamilton County, you're given the option to have what we call an ex parte hearing, which is a same day hearing on an emergency basis to see if a temporary order is necessary. Protection orders are typically a two hearing case. So you have that initial same day hearing where a magistrate or judge says, yes, I think you're at imminent risk of harm. And then they set it for a second hearing. At that second hearing, your abuser has to be served. So they are going to get a copy of what you filed. And then they have the chance to appear at that second hearing date. They have a right to cross-examine you. So if you testify, they get to ask you questions.
The abuser gets to ask you
questions. So it's inherently a very re-traumatizing process. And also there is a burden of proof that the petition or the survivor has to meet to get the protection order. And sadly, I don't know that our law about what is defined as domestic violence necessarily matches what we understand culturally for domestic violence to look at. So even if you are experiencing what we understand as abuse, sometimes it doesn't meet the legal standard for what we've defined as domestic violence or abuse.
Given how complicated that is, what's the process of getting somebody's gun taken away from them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So on the petition, when you file for a civil protection order, there is a place where you can mark that you know that the respondent, the abuser, has guns, and you can ask that the sheriff remove those guns when they are served if they're in the respondent's home. However, there's not really a good legal process to make sure guns are removed if the respondent isn't willing to tell the sheriff's office, here's my gun, I'll turn it over to you. So a lot of times it's just based on the respondent's word that yes, I have this gun here. It is. You can take it. Or if they say, nope, it's not in my house, the sheriffs really don't have the legal authority to go search the house and try to turn over all the beds and couches and cupboards to try to find the guns.
Or the car.
Or the car, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, we've been talking about physical abuse, but financial abuse is another way abusers gain power and control in relationships. Kristen, how often is financial abuse a factor in the cases that you all deal with at Women Helping Women? What kind of forms does that take?
I would say 9 out of 10 times. The survivors we are serving are absolutely experiencing economic abuse. And I think it's a really important aspect to highlight because it's another type of injustice. And so I think a lot of times when people think about intimate partner violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, you know, their mind immediately goes to the physical thing that they can see. And what they're not often seeing is the credit that is ruined. They are not seeing the bank accounts that are being stripped. They are not seeing the economic coercion of what it looks like when the abuser who's operating from power and control is demanding to have all the money. They're not seeing the power and control in limiting the survivor to the workplace. You know, how dare you show up to work on time, or how dare you have a job? How dare you have some method of autonomy and to drive your own economic stability. So unfortunately, a lot of what we've seen, you know, I mentioned we served about 10,000 survivors a year. We serve the most survivors in the state of Ohio. And what we've seen through our lens is, and the majority of those we serve are already living 200% below poverty. But I do want to be clear with that. Any single type of person can experience gender-based violence. But this happens to be folks that we are serving. And so when you're already struggling to make ends meet, and you're already struggling, as many are in this state, in this nation, with the economy, and now you're experiencing violence, a couple of things are happening. One, the economic burden of the violence is going on you. So for a survivor, a female survivor, that's about $103,000 of what she is now having to deal with. Increased visits to healthcare, missed work, trying to deal with mental health, behavioral health. And in addition to that, often what we're seeing a lot, and it's a huge concern, and that's why we try to stand up a remedy for it, survivors are being facing eviction. Because of the credit, the money, the access, all that, plus the property damage. And we are very concerned that when survivors and their children are evicted, and now they are facing homelessness, and the highest population of folks experiencing homelessness are due to domestic violence, we come back to where we started this conversation around homicide. Their risk goes up.
Are you seeing that with clients, Ivory, just the financial issues that they have after being victims and being survivors of domestic violence?
Oh, absolutely. I think financial control is a huge piece of it. And like we were talking about earlier with barriers to going to the court and filing for protection order, even if it is something that they need, that financial barrier of not having any resources or anywhere to go, even if you do get this protection order and get your safety, I think it's a big reason people go back to their abusers, because they don't have anywhere else to go and there's no other financial support for them. I think we see in court a lot, there's the question asked of like, why did you go back or why haven't you left? Economic barriers are a huge piece of that.
Yeah. So Kristen, tell us about what Women Helping Women is doing to stand up this remedy, the Survivor Equity Fund. Yeah. Tell us about that and how it helps survivors.
Yeah, well, we launched this idea for the Survivor Equity Fund when exactly what you were framing, when we realized survivors didn't have any cash for the next step for safety. Even if that meant changing the locks, didn't have it. Even if that meant enough money for transportation to get to court, didn't have it. Even if that meant to hurry up and get to a hotel for an emergency night, didn't have it. Even if it meant a security camera that a lot of folks have on their doorbells, didn't have it. So we realize by having the lack of access to cash was increasing their danger. So that's where we stood up the Survivor Equity Fund, and we're very grateful for being able to do this where it's a rapid response. It is structured as low barrier. You tell us a survivor, we believe you. We don't need proof of your income. We don't need proof of your victimization. You tell us what you need, and we're going to do our best to turn around the financial investment to make that happen. Because violence thrives on delay, so we have to act fast. So when I say we act fast, we're not doing wait lists. We're not doing, we'll get to you in a couple of weeks or a couple of months, which is pretty typical among a lot of entities. We're talking 72 hours, 3 days, 4 days. And specifically, what we've been able to do in the past 24 months, we have activated $1.6, $1.7 million specifically through the Survivor Equity Fund to impact over 2,000 survivors and then all of their children. And again, it's what they tell us they need. But when we look at that lion's share, where a heavy lift is in eviction prevention, as well as relocation. Utilities have skyrocketed. Survivors don't have the means for that. Also, you know, violence gets very, very creative. So if you are about to leave, or you're going to go to court, or you're going to need to get to your job, the abuser might, and we've seen this quite often, I'm going to slash all four of your tires. I'm going to, you know, take a baseball bat to the windows of your car. Well, even if they had a car, now they're stuck. So we have paid for car repairs, new cars. So we're very proud of that work. And we're hoping by the end of this year to activate about $700,000 more dollars.
Kristen, long term, what do you think that kind of support can mean, mm-hmm. not only for mm-hmm. survivors, but for the community as a whole?
It's a huge, and I hate to speak, you know, in like economic terms sometimes, but it's a huge return on investment. But even more so, it's a huge return on wellness and safety. Now, I know this sounds kind of far-fetched, and I thought it was until I read the research studies. And so this is how we know the program works, is we base it off of an evidence-based model. We are investing, you know, well above $1,500 or $2,000 or more, you know, with survivors. A research study that came out of Washington was proven with a baseline investment of $1,200 and then about $40, $60 flexible cash, very low price points here, resulted in 2 years. 2 years of that survivor and her children experiencing continued safety, mental health, physical well-being, and housing, because it was pairing the cash investment with the wraparound community services of support, and specifically crisis response support. So for me, when I talk about so much of this is preventable, it is, and it's not a huge scratch our head, this has to be rocket science, let's make it very complicated. It's very simple. And when you have things that are simple, you can take it to scale.
Well, I have been talking with Women Helping Women President and CEO Kristen Shrimplin and Legal Aid Society of Greater Cincinnati Senior Supervising Attorney Ivory McGuire. Thank you both so much for your time today and for this important conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.